That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Welcome to That's What She Said, conversations with interesting people from the world of sports, music, comedy, and more, talking about their lives, careers, successes, and failures. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. Happy New Year. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. Today's episode is a particularly interesting one for me, as I think it matters that we continue to have important conversations about sexual assault, and particularly why we as a society tend to victim blame, why we don't believe victims, and how we can change perspectives at an early age to limit the number of sexual assaults and also increase bystander awareness so that those who are around these kind of acts understand what's going wrong, how they can help, and how they can make a change. I wrote a story for ESPNW that, if you're interested in this topic, I think is especially useful, where I talked to a bunch of experts about victim blaming in particular and why we tend to, even without realizing it, focus on the actions of the victim, what that person wore, what they drank, where they walked, what neighborhood they were in, how they were sexually active or not in the rest of their life, instead of on preventing abusers and rapists, and also how institutions tend to protect their own versus protecting or ensuring the safety of its individuals. It's a really fascinating topic, and one that I think more people would be educated on and less ignorant to if they took the time to really engage in it and understand the nuances and the specifics of it. And to that end, Brenda Tracy is my guest today. She's a sexual assault survivor and an activist who has been traveling around college campuses and athletic departments, talking to schools, mostly football programs, at big name universities, big time programs, to their coaches and their students and their staff, about the issue. And about how, for far too long, we've only addressed men as the problem and not also as the solution. A 1995 study, which had data collected from 91 to 93, showed that male athletes are only about 3.3% of their gender student population, but were involved in 19% of reported sexual assault cases. And that, of course, doesn't include any that aren't reported, which is a large majority. And so I think as the problem continues to dominate our consciences, as we're hearing more stories of domestic violence, intimate partner crime, and sexual assault on campuses and in professional sports, a lot of us are wondering why it happens so often. Are there enabling things about being an athlete? Are there protections for these young men that that allow, you know, them to skate by early on and then believe themselves to be completely unable to be stopped, or that they will be protected if they do these things? And so these conversations, I think, are really important. And so it was great to have Brenda on, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with Brenda Tracy. A trigger warning before the interview starts: Brenda does talk a bit about her own assault.
That's what she said.
Happy to welcome in this week's guest, Brenda Tracy, the nation's leading advocate in the fight against sexual and relationship violence in college football. You may have seen or heard of her going around the country speaking to a variety of mostly college football programs, talking to student athletes about sports and the connection to sexual and relationship violence in her efforts to end rape culture. She also works with lawmakers in her home state in Oregon and has developed a campaign named Set the Expectation that she'll tell you about. This is someone who I have admired from afar for quite some time and have followed along with her travels on social media. So super happy to finally have you on the podcast, Brenda. And I know we're going to get into it later, why this is a momentous time for you in terms of trying to push forward some new stuff with the NCAA. But before we get to what's going on right now, we have to start at the beginning. So where are you from, and were you into sports as a kid?
I was, yeah. I was born in Alaska, but then I came to Oregon as a small child, and I've mainly lived in Alaska and Oregon my entire life. I was an athlete. I played volleyball and basketball, and ran cross country junior high and high school.
And so sports is not new to you, and it's something that's always sort of been a big part of your life before you got into all this advocacy work. So
you end up having two kids at a pretty young age, and you have two young boys at the age of 24 when this life-changing assault happens to you. And this, in talking about your visits to various programs around the country, you kind of have told various reporters who've written some really great stories about you, that sometimes you are worried about how bought in players and coaches might be to the story you're going to tell them and the work that you're doing. And as soon as you tell your story, the personal cost that it was to you, that's when they all sort of lock in and decide that they're going to be invested in this conversation and this presentation. So first of all, I guess, explain the feeling that you have standing in front of these big groups of men, and understanding that you are once again going to have to, share the worst part of your life.
Well, I've done this almost 100 times, stood in front of a room of people, and every time I feel nauseous, I feel kind of sick to my stomach. There's a fear. I think that I'm not going to be believed, or they're not going to take me seriously. Maybe somebody's going to laugh. Just those types of things. And so a lot of times I always sit at the front of the room. I'm usually like in an auditorium. I'll sit at the front of the room, my back to everyone, so I don't see everyone come in, because I get very nervous about the numbers and the people.
Right.
And then I just walk up on the stage and I turn and I see everyone for the first time. And it's always terrifying. But I step on stage every time. I start sharing my story. And at first people are kind of, looking at me like, well, what she's going to say? We have to come to another one of these things. But when I start getting into the details of my story, and I talk about my story in very graphic detail, the room immediately goes quiet. People really look at me. I think some of them are kind of like, oh my God, I can't believe she's talking about this and saying these things. And people get very, very uncomfortable. So I do have them locked in at that point. And when I'm in a room full of men, they're very much engaged. They're very locked in. I'm sharing my story. And then I kind of get to the part where I'm going to kind of switch over and kind of talk about my activism. And you can kind of see them kind of tense. I think they feel like, oh, my God, she's about to drop the hammer on us.
Mm-hmm.
And what we heard was so horrific. Maybe we
right.
deserve it, that kind of thing. But then I say to them, I'm not here because I think you're the problem. I'm here because I know that you're the solution. And you will literally see them kind of exhale, drop their shoulders, and literally kind of lean in and listen to what I'm about to say. And that's the part for me that is magical every time, because then I know I have them in a place where they're thinking, what is she going to do? Why am I the solution? Why is she saying that? And how can I help? And then that's kind of that's the best part of the presentation for me, because I'm then moving into a space where there's hope. And there's inspiration, and it's not just the ugliness of what happened to me in my story.
Right, because it's not a scared straight or a I blame you. It's about educating and inspiring change. So you want them to understand consent. You want them to understand that as bystanders, they can actually do something. And you want them to understand that, the conventional ideas of masculinity may in fact be leading them to choices that they shouldn't make, or to expectations
right.
for themselves and the men and women around them that are unfair.
I read
a couple great stories, and I loved reading that there were specific players who would come up to you afterwards and thank you because of family members who were victims of domestic violence or sexual assault, had friends who had come to them asking for help about having been raped and didn't know what to do or how to help. And I think empowering them and saying that there's the solution is clearly so much better of a choice than merely to come in and preach at them about how too often men like them are the problem.
Yes, absolutely. And here's the thing I want everyone to hear from me. If women could stop sexual violence, we would have already done it. The
right.
fact that the onus is placed on us to stop it is, stupid.
Right.
I mean, that's like asking a child to end child abuse. These are the things that are happening to us, and predominantly it's men committing these acts of sexual violence. So it's like up to 98%, but it's like 10% of the male population doing it. So 90% of our men are good guys that don't do these things, but there's a huge problem with them being complicit in their silence and their inaction. So they know things are happening, they see things happening, but they're not getting engaged. So I talk to the 90% of those guys, and I help them understand why this is their issue, why they are the solution, why they need to align themselves with women in this work. And that's not being negative. That's not saying stop raping. That's engaging them and empowering them. And it's okay to educate people, but unless you've engaged them first and empowered them, you're probably not going to get very far with the education. And a lot of our guys feel like they feel kind of helpless. Like a lot of guys want to be part of the solution, but they don't know how. They don't. Right. They're scared to say something. They're scared to do something. And I think they feel like a lot of people just wag their fingers at them and tell them, you know, don't do this and don't do that. And they haven't had a woman stand in front of them and say, you're the solution. I want to work with you. Come sit at the table with me and let's figure out how to stop this violence. And it's true. The guys line up afterwards and they hug me and they shake my hand and they thank me for being there. I hear from them. I've been doing this work for about 2.5 years and I still hear from guys, you know, from somebody I talked to 2 years ago. And maybe I got a message the other day, in fact, that there was a young man who had, his mom had finally disclosed to him and his brothers that she was a rape victim. And he messaged me and said, because of you, I know how to be there for her. Mm. And that was a great gift for me.
Yeah.
I had men who call home after my session and their moms will say, you know what, that happened to me too. And young men who are survivors. I think that we cannot discount the fact that I hear from a lot of male survivors too.
Yeah.
1 in 6 boys in this country are sexually abused before the age of 18. Mm. And we don't talk about that, and we should.
Yeah, you know, I think in talking to young men, there seem to be a couple different responses, right? At least via my interactions. It's either defensiveness, right? Because not all men. And what you're hoping to tell them is, of course, not all men. That's why I'm here, because I want you to help me.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, I did a deep dive on victim blaming for a story I wrote about Larry Nassar, because the way in which all of those girls were responded to for so long before someone finally was able to break through and bring to the light how many people had enabled him, was almost, a hyper, like regular victim blaming times 1,000, because some of these girls were as young as 6, and it's impossible, no matter how much of a logistic, you know, like puzzle pretzel you put yourself in trying to find a way to blame a 6-year-old girl. You really can't, right? And so all of the things that we try to use, to blame women, how they dress or whether they drank or where they were walking, it's proven that this can happen from someone in your church, from a law enforcement officer, from a family member, right? And so all of those things start to melt away when you get into the details. But I think it's fascinating to actually address with people when they bring up the same old stereotypes that are associated with victim blaming. Here's why you're doing that, right? Here's why society over time has sort of taught us all, even women, to question what she did to bring it on herself, instead of understanding that there is no vulnerability without danger. You cannot be in danger unless somebody means to harm you. So that can't be the fault of the victim. They're not doing something that inevitably is dangerous, walking, having a drink, wearing a short skirt. It's only dangerous because someone means them harm. And I think that's probably a huge part of it for you, too, is to cut through, honestly, decades of society teaching all of us this is where we point the finger.
Yes. Yeah. And I talked to the young men about that. I talked to them about how, you know, when I was gang raped, the first thing I did when I walked out of the apartment was start blaming myself. And the reason I did that, I think, is because as a woman, you know, we're taught from a very, very small age how to protect ourselves and how to protect ourselves from men. So what I did is I went through this checklist in my mind of all the things I had been told to keep myself safe. Check your drink, always be with a friend, you know, all these things. And I went through and I checked off what I didn't do and what I did wrong. And then I blamed myself. It didn't occur to me, not even once after I walked out of the apartment, that I don't deserve to be drugged and gang raped, that I did nothing wrong, that I'm allowed to be at a friend's house. I'm allowed to exist. I'm allowed to walk this earth without being harmed. But I did that. And so as a society, we have to stop doing that. And victim blaming is just easy, right? If we can blame the victim, then we don't have to do anything.
Right.
We don't have to change policies. We don't have to hold people accountable. We don't have to fire a coach. We don't have to do anything. We can just say, well, that was your fault. And if you had done the right thing, this wouldn't have happened and it wouldn't be a problem. So we're just going to blame you. And that makes it really easy for us. It's kind of a scapegoat that we use, and we use it all the time. But one of the exercises I do with athletes, and I do this with survivors, and I've done this with myself, is, you know, the sentence, should rape be a consequence of, and then fill in the blank. So right. Should rape be a consequence of drinking? Should rape be a consequence of going to that party that your parents told you not to go to? Being in the wrong time at the place, at the wrong place, wrong time, whatever.
Yeah.
But should rape be a consequence of anything? No. The answer is no, and it's always no. It doesn't matter what you've done. It doesn't matter what you've not done. I don't care if somebody said there are rapists at that party, and you go to that party and you get raped. That is still not your fault.
Right.
You still did not do anything to make that person do that to you. Only a rapist chooses to violate another person's body.
So
it's
what would
their
you say?
Decision.
What would you say to somebody who tries to play devil's advocate and says, well, if we know that there is evil in the world, there are murderers, there are sexual assaulters, there are people who seek to do harm, is there a fault in telling people to take precautions to avoid that person, even if it's not their fault if it happens? Isn't it smart to tell people don't go in a bad neighborhood or don't have too much to drink?
Well, I think that there's obviously common sense things that we have to keep ourselves safe, right? That's why we lock our doors at night and, you know, we do certain things, right? But the real issue is that most of us know who our abuser is. So how do you keep yourself safe from the person that you know? The vast majority of people who are children who are sexually abused, it happens in their own home by someone they know. 80% of all women attacked on a college campus, they know their attacker. So you're having a drink or you're smoking weed or you're going to a party or you're doing whatever with people you think that you know. No one intentionally places themselves in a position to be sexually assaulted. I just don't believe that that happens. And so when it does happen, it's not the victim's fault. It's never the victim's fault.
And also I think, you know, there are so many studies in which a significant percentage of college age young men admit to having attempted to or successfully sexually assaulting someone. And very often in admitting doing so, they don't know that that's what it is, right? So you can say we are going to have a lot of trouble no matter what we do stopping truly evil people. The Larry Nassers of the world, right, can only be stopped by people speaking out and putting him in jail. That won't be stopped by bystanders telling people what consent is, and you know what I mean. But there are a lot of sexual assaults and rapes that are truly the result of not understanding consent, not believing or understanding that men are not entitled to women's bodies, right? Not understanding that alcohol or dressing a certain way or whatever doesn't tell you who or how she is. And that's the part I think that when people say, well, all you can do is try to protect yourself. No, we can actually change the minds and intentions of so many people. It's all about the conversation and the way society presents both men and women to each other.
Right. Exactly. Absolutely. 1,000%. And I talk about these things, you know, in my sessions. And I think one of the things too is, I know that when I'm in the room and I'm sharing my story, it's interesting because I've been to schools and I sat in a room where I know a rapist is there. I know that he's in the room and he's listening to me. And I share my story and it's interesting. No one identifies with the rapist in my story, but they identify with maybe the person who could have stepped in and helped me or done something. And the problem is that a rapist is not just someone who crawls through a window with a mask and a knife. Right? It's the guy in your study hall class, and it's the other athlete on your track team. They're normal people. And you're right. Guys don't think using alcohol to access a woman's body is rape. And I have to be really clear with them about that. If you use alcohol to access a person's body, that is no different than putting a gun to their head. It is the same thing. You are accessing their body without consent, without them saying, yes, I want to do this. So we have
especially
to be
really
clear.
Especially if you know they wouldn't do it without the alcohol. And that's been made clear.
Right. Exactly. But there is this culture. Just get her drunk enough and you can do whatever you want.
Right.
And that's something that we really have to talk about and we really have to address.
Well, and I think one of the root causes of that is this idea that has existed forever that sex is something men go after and something women have to eventually concede. And so if you always make it about pursuit, 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 then there's so much gray area in terms of does she really mean no, or is she saying that because she's supposed to? Right. Is the alcohol
right,
allowing
no
her to be the person
no
she really wants? Or is it, you know, because we can say, and I think a lot of women, I think, would say, I don't want to be sexually active with someone who doesn't want to be there. Right. Right. Like that seems pretty common sense for many of us. But it's not as common sense for some who, if they've always believed that it's about the chase and the pursuit, then there's some aspect that's like, oh, I got it. Even if that person that never consented and you know that they didn't want that before they were drugged or drunk or out unconscious.
Right. And we've taught our young men that no doesn't mean no. It means try harder.
Yes.
So then you have this whole conquer mentality. I'm gonna get some no matter what.
It's romanticized. It's great when a man shows up at a woman's office repeatedly to prove how much he really loves her, even if she continually says, no, I don't want to get back together with you. Right?
Yes. In romantic movies, he forcefully kisses her until she gives in.
Right?
And they walk off into happiness.
Yeah,
we see it all the time.
But when the women do it, it's crazy. Women are psychos.
Not talk.
Yeah. Women are psychos if they show up at your office. Men are romantic.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. And, you know, the man on the white horse rescuing the woman and the damsel in distress. You know, the whole thing. It's absolutely wrong. I mean, even, you know, I always think about things about, like, even though marriage, and we talk about marriage and divorce. Well, we socialize our girls to want to be married, and we socialize our guys to be bachelors, mm-hmm. right? Like, so how is a marriage ever going to work if we socialize our boys and our girls completely different on what they should want or need or whatever? So yeah, there's a lot of things that we have to look at, and kind of, you know, my job, I think, is not to, I guess I educate these young men, but a lot of times I just ask questions. Right. And I try to get them to do the work themselves. I try to get them to kind of look inside and be like, huh, she's right. Why is that? You know, because there's an example I use that, you know, if a dad takes his 2 5-year-old twins to the playground and they're playing on the monkey bars and they crash and they fall and they both skin their knees and they're both crying and they run to dad. And dad says to one, it's okay, baby, come here, and give them a hug. And then says the other one, get up, you're fine. Which one is the boy and which one is the girl? And then everybody gets it right. I've never had anyone get that question wrong. We all know who the boy is. We all know who the girl is. And then I say, why can't the boy get a hug? Mm-hmm. Right? Is the boy magically going to become gay and grow a vagina in that moment when dad gives him a hug? Like, no. The answer is no. And you'll see the guys think, like, yeah, why can't he get a hug? Like, what's the big deal? Why can't men cry? Why can't they have feelings, right? If you go through a breakup, we all have the same exact feelings. I don't care if you're a man or a woman or whatever. We all have the same exact feelings, but why are women allowed to process feelings and men are not? Why are women allowed to show feelings and men are not? You know, we talk about those things, and you can see their minds ticking and wondering, like, huh, you're right. Why is it like that?
Yeah.
and that is stupid.
It's fascinating for people who have had these conversations that it's still a shock to some, but it is, and especially in so many of the situations you're stepping into. You know, Don McPherson is one of my favorite advocates on these topics. He's been on the podcast talking about masculinity and also about how just what we consider to be masculine or tough or all the qualities we expect out of our male athletes, they just reinforce the worst of things in terms of, you know, being able to expose feelings and ask for help and treat people kindly and all the other stuff. And so you're walking into situations where you probably are dealing with a whole lot of people who haven't talked or thought about this stuff.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And I'll tell you that, you know, the moment that I say I'm here because I'm not here because I think you're the problem. I'm here because you're the solution. Most of them never even heard that.
Right.
It's a completely new concept to them that, oh, I could be the solution. What? If women could stop this, they would have already done it. What?
Right.
yeah, it's almost kind of mind-boggling for a lot of them. But it's so empowering, too. Like, it's so inspiring to see them think, like, oh, my gosh, I could get involved. And then actually see guys get involved. Like, that is so exciting for me. And I hope it inspires and gives hope to other people because, you know, seeing the guys I work with, you know, wear the Set Expectation ribbons on their helmets and they show up at Take Back the Night events and they're doing all these things. It's incredible that they feel engaged and empowered enough to be like, you know what, I am a good guy and I am going to be part of the solution and I'm going to make a difference. And I love that part of my work the most.
Well, let's talk about the story that you tell them and the story that got you invested in this cause. Obviously, I'm sure when you go speak to them, it's longer and it's in greater detail. And unfortunately, we don't have time for that because I do want to get into the work that occurred for you after this happened. But I think it's important for people to understand your story. And also, I think you are so well served by the fact that the men who did this to you essentially admitted it to the police.
Yeah.
Because you walk into a room and you demand that they believe you and they have no reason not to, no matter what kind of tricks they try to use to tell themselves this did not happen. It's clear that it did. And that's such a gift for you because unfortunately there are so many women telling their truths and not being believed. And that is just a secondary victimization every time it happens to them.
And that's one of the reasons I feel not obligated in a negative way, but I feel obligated to use my story to change things because I really do have a bulletproof story. John Canzano, who wrote my story, did a great job, and everyone admitted to what happened. Right. The DA, the police, the men. I mean, it happened, and there's no denying that it happened. And so I feel obligated because not every survivor has that. They don't have a police report. They don't have a rape kit. They don't have people going on record saying, yes, did this, yes, this happened. But it does happen all the time.
So tell us your story. And I did put a trigger warning at the beginning of this, but for those who may have fast-forwarded to the interview part, just a quick trigger warning here.
Yeah. So in 1998, as you previously said, I already had my two sons. I had my first son when I was 18 and in high school. I was in an abusive relationship with my son's father. It was full of domestic violence, and I got out of that relationship. And then a year later, in 1998, I started dating a college football player at Oregon State University, and my best friend was also dating a football player. And so one night she called me and she said, you know, will you go over to my boyfriend's place with me? His brother's in town from California, and I don't want to go alone. And, you know, we went everywhere together. I'd been there before, so I said, yeah, I'll go. I couldn't get a hold of my boyfriend that night. We didn't have cell phones back then. I always have to tell people, like, we didn't have cell phones back then. I couldn't get a hold of him. Because they're like, what do you mean you can't get a hold of him?
I left a message on his voicemail.
Yeah.
This thing. He had an answering machine.
Exactly. But so I went over there to the apartment with my friend. And when we got there, it was her boyfriend, who's also an Oregon State football player. The roommate was also a football player there. Her boyfriend's brother was in town. He was a recruit going to Cal. And then he had brought a friend with him who was a JUCO player from California. And then another guy later in the night showed up, and he was actually really close friends with my boyfriend and also football player. So we were there. I was offered a drink. At first I had said no, because I didn't actually drink back then. And then I was, you know, they kept asking me, like, Brenda, just have a drink. You never drink with us. Just have one drink. And I was like, okay, fine. I'll have a drink. So I was given a drink. I drank probably 4 ounces of it slowly. And then probably, you know, 10 to 15 minutes later, started feeling very kind of woozy and sick. And the room was kind of starting to move. And I felt like I was going to pass out. And I did pass out. And then for the next 6 to 7 hours, I was gang raped by 4 of those men. My best friend and her boyfriend were actually in the back bedroom of the apartment. So I was assaulted, and when I talk to my players, I talk about what they did to me. I talk about the fact that they used a flashlight on me. I talk about the fact that, you know, after 6 hours, they were complaining that they couldn't penetrate me anymore because I was so dry and swollen, so they put ice on me to try to, you know, help with the swelling. So I talk about all of these gruesome, horrible, awful details. And then I, you know, talk about the fact that the next morning when I woke up, I got my son from the back bedroom and we left. And then I ended up going to the hospital. I got a rape kit done. I went to the police. I reported. I talk about the fact on the way to the hospital, I was suicidal. I was actually going to kill myself, but then I met my nurse, Nurse Jenny, who did my rape kit. She inspired me to live and actually become a nurse. And then, you know, once I did the rape kit and I made the police report, I kind of thought that was where my episode of Law and Order would start. I was very naive about the process back then. I thought that you report a crime and then the bad guy's arrested and you go to court and they go to jail.
Right.
But this crazy backlash happened and I was not prepared for that. The first thing that happened was my community called me a liar. I mean, cause it was a news story immediately. Like as soon as they got arrested, it was in the newspaper, on the radio. And I was the top story on the news, on the television. Thank God we didn't have social media back then. But I was Jane Doe, but people knew it was me, people in my community. And the first thing they did is call me a liar. Mm. Why is she trying to ruin their lives? And I didn't understand that because I was the victim of a crime, but now I was also a perpetrator because I was trying to, ruin their lives. The guy I was dating didn't think that his friend should go to prison for this, so he didn't want anything to do with the case. My best friend didn't think that, she turned on me, I think, in an effort to protect her boyfriend and his brother, who was also facing prison time. And said that she would testify against me in court if I pursued the charges. So I lost my best friend, pretty much lost everyone except for my parents and my kids. Very isolated, very hurt. It was a very, very hard time. I was receiving death threats also. People would call and threaten me and my children. So, and then the DA told me I didn't have a good case. The DA at the time said it's a he said, she said case, and I'd have to go through 4 separate trials. And that my rape kit would be made available to the public, which meant every photo of every inch of my body, inside and out, would be made public. And
did the DA have the police report where they had all admitted to doing it?
Yeah, I'm getting to that part.
Okay. All right.
In 1998, at that time, the DA said to me, are you sure you want to do this? And I was like, well, no, if I can't win, then what's the point? Like, I'm going through hell right now. And I was suicidal. I was like barely clinging to life at that point. And I just wanted to go to school. 2 months after my rape kit, almost to the day I started school, I became a registered nurse. And then I had reported. So the DA said that I dropped the charges. And then that was a news story, right? And then my community said, see, we told you she's a liar because if she was really raped, she would prosecute. Or the DA would prosecute if she was really raped, right? So automatically I was called a liar because people don't understand that DA is dropping charges, declining to prosecute, or, not guilty doesn't mean innocent, doesn't mean I'm a liar. But people don't understand that even today. Mm-hmm. So I went to Oregon State. I was not a student there. I reported to them because it didn't want it to happen to anyone else. They said they would take care of it in-house. We had a very long discussion about that. I believed them. And I thought I could move on with my life. Then another story came out from the football team because this was right before the football season started. And when Coach Riley, who was the head coach then, Coach Mike Riley, was asked about what happened with his players being arrested and the charges being dropped and everything, he said these are good guys that just made a bad choice. Mm. And I read that and was angry and hurt. I didn't understand how he could minimize my life to just nothing and why no one cared about me and everyone seemed to care about them and their lives and their futures. And then I watched them play. I watched all of them play football. I watched tens of thousands of people cheer for them every Saturday and tried to move on with my life. For the next 16 years, I raised my kids. I became a registered nurse, but I dealt with depression. I was suicidal. I had PTSD. I hated myself. I was living in a prison of shame and silence, and it was hell. And then in 2014, I decided that I wanted to, through a series of events, I kind of ended up meeting John Canzano. And he said, I'll write your story. And I was like, what story? Who cares? Like, it happened 16 years ago. Nobody cared then. Why would they care now? And he was like, no, you could help somebody and I'll write your story. And I was like, all right, fine. Put my name and my face on it. And people ask me today, how did you find the courage to put your name and your face in your story? But it really wasn't courage. I was just so desperate for change in my life. Like, I was just tired of being sick and tired. And I thought maybe if I put my name and my face on my story, maybe that next day after it ran, maybe that would be the first day in 16 years that I woke up and didn't want to die. So it wasn't courage. It was just desperation. But the story ran. And this time when the story ran, my community embraced me. They believed me. Survivors reached out to me. It was a really amazing moment for me. I really kind of walked out of my prison of shame and silence that day when I went public. And it was a huge moment for me. But people had questions about what happened back then. So John Canzano and Oregon State University did their own internal investigation, and John Canzano did an investigation. And a month later, December 2014, I got the results. So what really happened back in 1998 was they had a football stadium, but it was called Parker Stadium. And they were trying to renovate the football stadium, but they needed millions of dollars. And they were courting the Reeser family at that time for this money to renovate the football stadium. The athletic department was also $1 million in debt. So back then, the DA, the police, and the university president would get together to talk about how to take care of football. And they obviously had a conversation about me. So the DA actually admitted that they lied to me. They had taped confessions from all four men that I was not told about. The police did not test my rape kit. They threw it in the trash 3 years before the 6-year statute of limitations was up. I was not notified. They threw my evidence away. And the university president told everybody, don't talk about Brenda. And nobody did. The counselor that I reported to at the school, she actually went to the, I don't know if it was the DA or the police office. I'm not sure which one. But she got the police report and took it to the school. So literally everybody knew exactly what happened to me, but everyone decided to do nothing. And 1 year later, they renovated the football stadium. They got a $5 million check from the Reeser family. So it worked. And I found out all of this information 16 years later. I found about the betrayal and the cover-up. And unfortunately, there was nothing I could do. The statute of limitations had ran. I wasn't a student. There were no laws about rape kits. DAs have immunity. They get to pick and choose their cases. So there's literally nothing I could do. So I was just given this information, and people just kind of said, oh, sorry.
Right.
And then that's when my activism started.
Hey, everybody. Don't forget to go to ESPN and Apple Podcasts and subscribe to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain so you always have the latest episode. Don't forget to rate and review it as well and tell all your friends how awesome it is.
So a couple questions based on that. Knowing what you know now about victim blaming, about the way people react to these stories, what do you think your best friend was thinking when she took the side of the other men? What do you think the people in your life, other than your family and your sons, were thinking when they immediately assumed that you would bring this on yourself by making up this story?
Yeah, so if you read through the police report, Carmen is one of the hardest things for me to talk about. And I don't talk about her very often because that betrayal runs deeper, I think, than anything else for me. Mm-hmm. She's my best friend. But when you read the police report, it sounds like she brought me over there knowing what was going to happen to me, maybe not knowing the extent, but it kind of promised me to them that I would do something with one or all of them. I don't know. Because one of the men kept saying in the police report, oh, Carmen said she's like that. Carmen said she's like that. Mm. And then at one point, you know, I was passed out on the floor and they were just kind of stepping over my body and some argument they had in the early morning. So she didn't even like help me, you know, get up off the floor, get on the couch. So she knew what happened to me. I know she knew what happened to me. Actually, when we left the apartment that morning, we got in our car to leave. I was crying kind of uncontrollably and inconsolable. And she reached out, she put her hand on my thigh and she said, Brenda, it's going to be okay. We just got in over our heads. And I knew in that moment she knew what happened to me. Because what does that mean? We just got in over our heads.
Right.
So then, of course, you know, she turned on me. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't blame you for being upset. Then there's like a whole new set of questions of what has had to happen to a person that they're willing to put their friend in that situation, you know?
And not only that, but then to take their side. You know, when I'm going to prosecute and I'm going to move forward with my court case, then say to me, if you go to court, I'll testify against you in a way to get me to stop. You know, that was her intention. Her intention was to get me to stop moving forward. Everyone's intention was to get me to stop moving forward with prosecution. And unfortunately, it worked. And I was not strong enough. Well, and you know what? I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to blame myself for that because the DA told me I didn't have a good case. I took the information that I made an informed decision based on what the DA told me. So I'm going to check myself on that. I'm not going to blame myself for that. I did nothing wrong.
Right. And a reminder that, as it turned out, you didn't know at the time, but all of the men had essentially admitted to a variety of different illegal acts. They had all incriminated themselves. They had all admitted to it. And so the fact that you were told that there was no case is baffling, but also I think probably more frustrating years later to find that it was an open and shut case, and you were still encouraged not to do anything. So imagine cases that are not as open and shut and how difficult it is for someone to believe that they should go forward with it.
Oh, yeah, this still happens. This still happens. I mean, people, when I share my story and I tell them what happened to me, their jaws drop open, and I'm like, I'm not unique. This is happening. It's still happening today, especially in sports and athletics and college football, when there's so much money and, you know, all these things involved. These things are still happening. These conversations and backdoor deals and whatever, this is still happening. I'm not a unique case. I'm just one that can be proven, which I think is important for us to understand. Like, these things really do happen. Because honestly, if I had just heard this and people had not admitted to it, I myself would even have been like, what? No way. That can't be true. You know what I mean? Like, the DA and the police are supposed to be there for me, not them. Like, why? What? That's crazy. How can you have someone say that, you know, how can you have someone say that they admitted to being part of a gang rape and then just do nothing?
Right. Yeah.
How does that work? How do they get 25 hours community service and a one game suspension?
Right. And that's why it's so hard when everything in sports, people always say, well, just let legal handle it, because law enforcement has failed so comprehensively on holding people accountable. You know, you said the second time when the Oregonian journalist wrote a story about you that you were universally supported. Was that simply because he had so many facts and it was undeniable, or was it also a change in the way people saw these kind of stories and in society in general?
No, I think it was based on his writing and reporting. I absolutely do think that. Because I don't, you know, this was before the Me Too movement. So there wasn't really necessarily a huge shift in our consciousness at that point as a nation. So I definitely think it was the reporting. I think people were just like, oh my God, everybody admitted what happened to this poor woman.
And so that feels good.
In the first story, the first segment, even before the next month when, you know, it came out, what really happened, people supported me. But yeah, I think that was John Canzano's reporting. I don't think that was a national shift in consciousness at that point.
So it feels
to say it was. But
yeah, not
I
yet. Not yet. So you have people supporting you, but you find that even with therapy and even as you're, you know, getting your MBA, buying a house, all the stuff that it's not quite enough. There are still things that bring you pain. And one of them is being failed by police, being failed by the institution of Oregon State and by Coach Riley. And that led you to the final kind of piece of all of this, right? Is that desire to close up that final loop.
Oh yeah. My activism absolutely was started from all of this. I kind of took my pain and, you know, turned it into a purpose. And that's what I've been, you know, doing for the last 4 years of my life, since coming forward. And I think that's, you know, that's where my drive comes from. I think that's where, you know, people are like, you know, Brenda, you keep going. And I'm like, well, yeah, nothing's changed. Wait, like, things are not changed enough. Like, this could still be happening. I don't want what happened to me to happen to anyone else. And so, yeah, all of those things that happened have really been the catalyst for me to figure out, you know, what are the things I can do to make sure it doesn't happen to anyone else?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to me that in, I think it was The Ringer, the great Ringer story that was written about you. You talked about how you almost hated Coach Riley more than the men who raped you because felt like that's what people, if you're a bad guy and you want to rape someone, that's such a different choice than being this good guy, this coach that everyone says is so great, who decided that my life wasn't important enough for more than one game suspension. And I think those secondary victimizations, I think anybody who goes on Twitter and messages you that women are liars or that you're a liar, they don't understand that feeling like you've been let down by all of these other people in addition to the initial issue, and especially by institutions like the police or colleges or places that in theory are supposed to protect you, is almost worse somehow.
Yes, it is. And that's why I think people have a problem when I take such issue with people like Art Briles and Kendall Briles getting a new job, they don't understand why I take such issue with that. But I did hate Coach Riley more than my rapist. And it's because I can rationalize a rapist. I can't rationalize good people not doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And when we look at all of the enablers and people who turn a blind eye and they're complicit in their inaction, they're complicit in their silence, I do hold those people accountable. I do think it's just as bad, if not worse, than the person who committed that crime. And it's why these things continue to happen. That's why these things continue to happen, because we have so many people who are complicit in propping up and enabling these cultures. So, yes, I'm going to go after those coaches that enable and prop up these cultures, because if they weren't doing that, there wouldn't be as much violence. They are absolutely complicit in these things, and they should be held accountable.
So you've worked in Oregon, the state of Oregon, to expand the statute of limitations for victims of these crimes to pursue some sort of justice. You
Yes.
were on the NCAA Commission to Combat Campus Sexual Violence for 2 years, and that commission has been disbanded. What
Yes.
happened? Why? And what are you doing to try to fight to have that returned?
Yeah, so back when the Baylor scandals first hit the news, I was really upset by that. I didn't understand how almost 20 years later these things were still happening. And my son, my older son, Darius, came to me and said, you know, Mom, I want to help you. And I was complaining about the NCAA because I didn't understand why they had, like, no stance on the issue. So my son said to me, Mom, I want to help you. What if I wrote a letter to the NCAA? And I said, well, are you sure? You know, because I didn't want to put him in the crossfires of, you know, all my trolls and everybody on social media. But he said, yeah, Mom, I want to do this for you. And I was like, okay, you know, let's do this. So he wrote this beautiful letter to about me and being the son of a rape survivor, and sent it to all 19 of the Board of Governors and the NCAA. They then responded. A couple hundred thousand people signed that. He put in a petition on change.org. A couple hundred thousand people signed it. The NCAA responded by convening the Commission to Combat Sexual Violence, and I sat on that. And we talked about eligibility and accountability. We talked about, you know, why are we allowing violent athletes to play sports? Shouldn't sports be a privilege and not a right? Why is one athlete, you know, kicked out of a school for gang rape, but then can just get on another team? Why are there guys with, you know, felony convictions still able to play sports? So I sat on the commission for 2 years. We talked about it, and then ultimately the Board of Governors decided to do nothing. The Big Sky Athletic Conference actually put together a policy, a serious misconduct policy. It's the most comprehensive in the country. That policy was given to the NCAA by the commissioner at that time, who sat on the Commission to Combat Sexual Violence with me. And the commission recommended to the Board of Governors that they tell all three divisions, we need to do something about eligibility. But the Board of Governors said, no, we're going to continue to track this issue. So everything was disbanded and nothing was done. And I was very frustrated by that. So what I did was I talked to another commission member, Cody McDavis, who is a former D1 athlete. And he was part of helping start the It's On Us campaign. And we said, you know what? We don't need the NCAA. We can just go to each individual conference and we can say to them, you need to do something about violent athletes. They don't belong in these conferences. And so we've started a new petition, change.org/NCAA. And we have, I think, 210,000 signatures at this point. But we're going to each individual athletic conference in this country and saying, could you please ban violent athletes? Could you please send the message that playing sports is a privilege and not a right? If you have a criminal misdemeanor or felony charge for domestic violence or sexual assault or rape, you don't get to play sports. And so that's what we're working on right now. And I'm going to be pushing that really hard in 2019 because I believe that behavior matters. And if we would attach eligibility to behavior the same way that we attach eligibility to grades, we will see a shift in the culture. If we know, if a young man in high school knows my behavior matters, and if I harm someone, I'm not going to my dream college, what happens in his mind? How does that change things for him? And not only that, but all the people around this young man grooming him to go to college, they are now forced to have conversations with that young man because his behavior matters. So now we're going to have conversations about consent. drinking, healthy relationships, and those kinds of things because we want to keep him eligible. So this will work. I know that it will work. It's already started to work in the Big Sky Conference. And, yeah, it's like one of my number one initiatives this month. So anyone that wants to sign, get involved, please do. This is one significant way that we can change things.
And again, petitions at change.org/NCAA.
Yes.
So a lot of there's a lot of, I think, differing opinions on kind of one and dones, right? Experts I have talked to have said, at least at the professional level, that it will likely discourage people from reporting because they won't want to feel like their financial situation might be lost if they want to continue the relationship or if they are getting death threats because it's a famous person, right? And they say it's better to try to figure out how to punish for the sake of change versus PR, right? So if you just immediately say you're never allowed in the NFL again when you do this, that person's not likely to change. They've lost all of their support system. They've lost their job. They've lost their money. What real impetus is there to invest in that person and invest in them not going off and doing this and recidivism occurring? It's a little bit different at the collegiate level, obviously, but you know, how do you reconcile that idea of maybe they'll cover it up even more if they know they're going to lose this athlete forever versus this will teach athletes that their actions have consequences?
Right. Well, I think we have to think about the fact that, you know, in the beginning stages of these things, things are not going to be perfect, right? And this is work that has to be done over time. But the thing that we have to do is we have to reach back, right? This stuff has to start in high school.
Mm-hmm.
We have to start talking to our young men, right? Athletes don't become violent when they sign a pro contract. That's not what happens. These attitudes, these beliefs, these behaviors have been cultivated, and it probably started in high school. And then it just got worse. And we have failed these men by not holding them accountable at different stages. We have failed them by not having conversations about consent and healthy relationships. We have failed them by just looking at them as commodities, right? Because at some point, we identify that a young man has athletic ability, and then we start coddling them and place this protective fence around them, right? Because we're trying to get them to the pros. Or we're trying to get them to that college level D1 program. And so when the girl in high school says, he hit me, we say, well, you know what? We don't want to ruin his chances to go to college and better himself.
Mm-hmm.
So let's not say anything. And then he goes on to college. And then he hits another girlfriend, right? And then we're like, yeah, but you know what? He's going to go to the NFL. And we don't want to ruin his chances to go to the NFL. So let's not say anything, right? And then they're in the NFL, and then they hit their wife. And then we're going, oh, we don't know what to do.
Right.
Well,
right.
What we need to do is we need to reach back further. And I think that when we look at the NFL, I think that for me, this is a college problem. These colleges are sending these men to the NFL. The idea that we're just saying, oh, the NFL needs to deal with it. No, the NFL needs to reach back. They need to hold colleges accountable, and
college coaches need to
hold high schools accountable. It's a pipeline. These guys are going through a pipeline. And I absolutely believe that if we implement a policy that, you know, you don't get to play sports if you harm someone, I think over time what we do is we shift attitudes. It's not going to be anything that's going to be perfect right in the beginning. But 10 years down the road, it's going to be different because we're going to be forced to have conversations with these athletes because we're not having them right now. All we care about as a society is, are they on the field and are they winning for us? We really don't care about anything else. The
right.
whole system is kind of corrupt. When we look at big football and NFL and everything else, really, these guys are commodities. They're not humans. They're, you know, we hear shut up and dribble. Don't bring your politics into it. Don't kneel. Don't this. Don't that. Well, they're human. They have lives. But we don't really care about that. We care about, are they winning?
Right.
Are they on the field entertaining us? And for me, that's really frustrating. And I don't want to look at them as commodities. And I think that attaching eligibility to behavior is one way to say, we care about you and we're going to have these important conversations. Yeah, I want you to go to the NFL, but I want you to enjoy it. I want you to be a positive influence on your community. I want you to use that stage and that platform to be a role model. it's sad to me when I see men getting in trouble in the NFL, and I always wonder who failed him and when did it first start and who didn't have those conversations with him.
That's the big part of it, right, is that if you want eligibility to be affected by these actions, then that's about the coach's caring, right? Because we hear there's a great podcast about Aaron Hernandez, failed a drug test early on at Florida and somehow never failed another one, even though he said later in life he smoked weed before every game. Right. So someone is choosing to turn a blind eye to that. And so you have your set the expectation.
So we're failing victims and them. Yeah.
Right.
We're failing everybody. Yeah. Well, and it always upsets me when people act like, oh, you don't care about these players. Yeah, I do. And my players know I care about them. Everyone that I work with, they know that this is about not only helping victims and preventing violence, but also helping them.
Right. Your Set the Expectation campaign asks coaches and players to sign a pledge that they understand sexual and domestic violence is never okay and won't be tolerated, and that perpetuating violence might result in being dismissed from their team.
Yes.
Has that ever come up? Because there can't be a 100% success rate where everybody heard you and now they're doing the right things. That's my only concern is this is, of course, and as you said, it's never going to be perfect right from the start. This is exactly what they should be told, they should be listening to, they should be agreeing to. The question is whether that accountability ever shows up on the other end if they break it.
Yeah, so not, and here's the thing about the pledge. The pledge attaches eligibility to behavior, because I believe that that's something that can work for you know, a shift in this culture. And not a lot of teams have signed it, I would say. I've been to more schools than have signed it, and I think that's because this is a, the coach, if you have your team sign the pledge, you're taking a public stand that I am going to hold my players and my staff accountable, right? Because it talks about staff too. So you're making a public stance, I'm going to do this. So if something comes up, right? So we're going to be looking at you going, you signed the pledge. You said you would do this. So now what are you going to do, right? Are you going to follow through? And so there have been some coaches who've had the courage to be like, yeah, I'm signing this and I'm going to do this. Coach David Shaw is one of them. And he uses the pledge as a way to create a culture on his team, which is really amazing. Other coaches don't. And so I think that there have been some coaches I've worked with that have taken good steps. I'm gonna talk about Coach Harbaugh for one. He has a player on his team who, before I went there, had an issue with the police, and he's on the team right now. And then I went and I spoke with him and I shared my story and everything. And then we know that recently he let go of a player for a domestic violence charge. And I like to think, I have not asked him that, but I like to think that because I was there, because he's been involved with me, because we had this discussion, because we talked about eligibility, because we talked about culture change and the way that he and the team can make a difference. I like to think that that had something to do with why that player was let go. And I think that that is hard. I know that it's not easy for us to let go of our players. I know our coaches, know these kids. They know the background. They know the families. But these are the hard decisions that need to be made now, because once you do that, you send a message to the rest of the team. This is not okay. This will not be tolerated. This will not be accepted. And I do think that that changes the mindset of these players. And if you have a team that has this culture of accountability and you have a player who crosses the line anyways, do you want that kid on your team?
Right.
Do you want a kid on the team who has drawn the line in the sand and the kid steps over the line anyways? Is that a good fit for the team anyways? So,
And as much you're hoping that the players will protect each other, right? If someone is in a bad situation or they think someone is going to make a bad decision, by being there and hearing you, they may be more likely to step in as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Coach Shaw is the most amazing example in this country. He signed the pledge immediately when it came out in April, I think it was 2017. He signed the pledge. He had the entire team sign the pledge when I was there. He uses the pledge as a way to create a culture. So every kid that comes on the team, he sits with them and they sign it. They talk about it. So you know if you're going to Stanford, you have to sign this pledge. You know before you get there, this is the culture. This is what we stand for. This, we hold each other accountable as a team and coaching staff. He has set the expectation on the team room wall in the front of the room, so the guys see it every day. He hosts a Set the Expectation game every year. He's done two of them now, raising awareness and giving back for survivors. So it's part of the culture. It's a pillar of their program. So so I love the idea that if you know that's the culture, if you're a predator, you're not going to go to Stanford. That's just common sense, right? Predators hunt where they're allowed to get away with it.
Yep.
So if you know there's a culture of accountability, you're not going there. You're going to go to a different school where you think you can get away with it.
Right. That's what the experts say. They do find places where they know people are likely to protect the institution over the morality of the people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's been proven a million times over that predators hunt where they can get away with it. So, and not only that, but then, you know, the team, you know, they're wearing set expectation t-shirts. They have wristbands at Stanford. They're going to take back the night. They're getting involved. It's becoming a thing that's spreading. The culture is spreading across the campus now. And so that's the other thing, right? If you're a predator and you go to a party on a college campus, but there's a couple guys from the football team there, right? You're probably not going to hunt at that party either. You're probably going to leave because you know that those guys are the ones that have said, I'm going to step in. If I see something, I'm going to say something. I'm going to do something. People on my campus are safe. This is not happening on my campus.
Right.
When you have that culture and you have those people, especially football players, it changes things. And predators go other places. And because of that, people are safe.
Yeah. Well, it's such important work that you're doing. We could talk forever, but we're out of time. I was inspired by you connecting with Coach Riley and changing his perspective and being able to forgive and involve him in the solution. And for those who obviously might not ever have a chance to go see Brenda speak at a school, like I said, there's a really fantastic Ringer article from last year. There's a couple great ones from this year as well, including one on The Athletic. But there's a great Ringer article about the work that she does, getting into detail about her story as well that I would highly recommend. And then your petition is at change.org/NCAA, so everyone can go check that out too. Thanks so much for coming on the show. I'm just so impressed by the work you're doing. You're so important.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity to kind of elevate my voice and the message and the mission. Because I really believe that, you know, if we all work together, we can change this. It's not impossible. We really can do it.
Yeah, I agree. It's just slogging through, right? Getting through to people that need to be told. Thanks, Brenda. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Oh, and another thing.
This week's That's What She Read is the Athletic story that I mentioned a couple times in my interview with Brenda Tracy. It's by Katie Strang, and it was posted back in September of 2018. The headline is, "By sharing her story, sexual assault survivor Brenda Tracy makes an impact across the country." It's just an incredibly well-written story that gets even more into detail exactly what happened with Brenda's assault. And the various ways in which she was failed by the system, by coaches, by those around her, and how she has taken her own, at times, hopelessness and turned it into a cause. And it's really worth reading. Again, by Katie Strang in The Athletic. And its headline is, "By sharing her story, sexual assault survivor Brenda Tracy makes an impact across the country." Thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
That's what she said.